It is Monday, October 14th, 2014, and this is episode 38 of the Defensive Security Podcast. My name is Jerry Bell. Tonight, I am joined by Mr. Andrew Callett.
Good evening, everyone. Happy to be here yet again.
And as usual, the thoughts and opinions we express in this podcast are ours and do not represent those of our employer. So, first off, I'd like to apologize for not recording on the normal day. But, you know, sometimes you have to work through the weekend. So, as is usual, we have a fun-filled spate of stories for you. And first up is one that Mr. Callett sent. And this is about it's actually a study that was done by a university relative to different personality traits lending themselves to vulnerability to phishing attacks. And I thought this was pretty cool. It's a fairly short study, and the link to the PDF is in the show notes. But basically, there was, I would say, a couple of main findings. Number one was, if you think about the Big Five framework for personality traits, the trait of neuroticism highly correlates to vulnerability to phishing. And also, it was interesting that apparently females are more vulnerable than males.
Yeah, it's this will probably cause a wee bit of controversy, but it's interesting. Go on.
So the point here is to help organizations understand the psychological implications or psychological factors that go into vulnerability to phishing attacks. And there was another interesting finding in here, and that is that people's perceived awareness about the risk of phishing attacks and their familiarity with computers doesn't seem to correlate to their ability to resist phishing attacks.
Yeah, it was interesting. The folks who thought they were really good at spotting them, and the folks who didn't think they were good at spotting them had no statistical relevance. What I find somewhat interesting about this is it sort of talks to the concept of one-size-fits-all defense does not work. And, you know, we do all these sorts of personality studies for different aspects of management and different aspects of leadership. Maybe now we need to start looking at personality studies for different aspects of user education and user awareness and different ways that we deal with different people on these sorts of things.
Exactly right. I think that's a great point.
So, but it is fascinating. It makes sense, right? It's sort of, it's a common sense thing. You know, it's kind of like, well, yeah, okay. Certain people are more gullible than others, or certain people are more, you know, whatever than others. But to actually have some good scientific proof around it is kind of interesting, I thought. And ultimately, it proves once again that all security is local to your environment and your specific situation. And there's a reason that, you know, certain folks are more susceptible than others. They also talked a lot about Facebook, which I thought was interesting as part of it. That probably helped them get some grant money when you put Facebook in it. But, you know, those folks who are more likely to share more information on Facebook and not set their privacy settings, surprise, surprise, are also more likely to follow phishing links.
Yeah, that was kind of interesting, too. I was a little... I don't know what I was thinking. It seemed like they were kind of trying to mix or at least cover too much ground with this study, I thought. But, you know, it's interesting that, as you mentioned, there are some similarities in the same personality traits that lead someone to be likely to follow a phishing link to also sharing too much. So, interesting study.
Yeah, perhaps we start setting our defensive posture on different machines based on the user's personality profile. Could be an interesting thing to pursue.
Ooh, that's interesting.
Sorry, you
controversial.
Are, yes, you are neurotic. Therefore, everything for you is VDI. You get a virtual desktop that gets recreated every day. You are stable, quote unquote. You get to do whatever you want. Here's admin rights. You know, that would be, you know, who knows? That could be it. Now, you know, in the interest of fairness with this study, it's pretty limited. They only used 100 folks. They only looked at one type of phishing email, which was a prize type email. So they were only triggering one type of emotional response. And this is sort of an initial foray into this. But I think it's worth watching, you know, kind of the human factors issues around phishing and social engineering is not something that we seem to know a ton about as an industry. And I think this is helpful to start, you know, peeling back the layers of the onion a little bit.
Yeah, definitely. One thing I would fault the study for is a pretty limited audience size. I think there was 87 males and 13 females, if I recall right. So, you know, it may be hard to really draw firm statistical conclusions from that. But, you know, I think it's interesting. And hopefully we see some more studies, maybe with bigger audiences.
I think we should write a grant proposal.
It's a great idea.
Screw this corporate world. We're going to live off the government dole.
I love it. All right, moving on. So did you know that iOS is not as secure as Android?
Says who?
Says the CEO of Google.
How does he define less secure?
Well, see, that's I guess the million-dollar question, right?
All right.
Nobody really knows. You know, if you don't apply any metric or, you know, or context to the statement, yeah, you can say, you know, anything is more secure than anything else.
Thank you for joining us on the Flame War part of the show. Next week, we'll be talking about Windows versus Mac OS.
No. So this is...
Ubuntu or Linux? Raw Linux. What is your preference?
This is becoming a, as you pointed out, right, a religious war similar to the Mac versus Windows of days gone by. And, you know, interestingly, there are some similarities between iOS and Android and Mac and PC of long ago. But I have a hard time just... given what I know and what I've read and, you know, just the reality of the situation, kind of on any basis saying that Android is, you know, quotes, secure or more secure than the iPhone. And, you know, when you kind of peel it away, right, there's, I think it was 79% of malware, mobile malware is for Android. 1% is for iPhone.
According to an FBI and Department of Homeland Security study. So
correct. Fair enough.
Take that with a grain of salt.
Yep.
And, you know, Juniper came out and said with their study that multiple malware was up 614% between March 2012 and March 2013, and that they said 92% targeted Android. Okay, so now the question becomes why? Right? Why are more targeting Android? We can't necessarily say it's a you know, market share issue. There's certainly plenty of market share for iOS.
Exactly.
Is there something more successful in the application sandboxing and vetting on Apple's submission process than Google? Or they also forward here that, you know, a lot of the problems is people aren't upgrading their Android phones. Now, for whatever reason, Apple's done a phenomenal job of getting their users to upgrade, whether yes. you like it or not. That, you know, you look at the adoption rates of like iOS 7, it's phenomenally good. Android, that's just a different model. People don't upgrade as often. People just, they, for whatever reason, you know, you could talk about fragmentation, you could talk about all sorts of stuff, but people don't upgrade nearly as aggressively on Android models. And I wonder if that is part of the reason.
I think there's two distinct things going on there. Number one is exactly what you said. And as I understand it, now I don't have an Android device, you know, but I, you know, I know people that do, and obviously there's plenty of news about this. But the problem is, that for the most part, as an Android user, you're completely beholden to your carrier to get updates. And apparently carriers are really not very motivated.
Do you mean OS updates?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So, you know, I think the metric was something like only 4% of Android devices are running the current version.
Wow. Now, I do know that Android as an operating system is much more aggressive about pushing new hardware versions, and that old devices are much more quickly orphaned on the Android side of the house than they are on the iOS side of the house. So then it becomes a matter of, can you run the new version, right? Can you run it adequately, et cetera, et cetera? You know, the interesting thing I would love to know more about is of this mobile malware, is it actually attacking the OS itself, or is it going after commonly deployed applications on the OS? And that's one thing I don't know. I honestly don't know. Like, what is it exploiting? What is it going after? I'm guessing it's primarily going after the operating system. But, you know, I don't have any stats to know that. And
a lot of it is, I took a class recently that did some analysis on mobile malware, and a lot of it was focused on the Android platform, and a lot of the malware is focused on data theft and premium SMS text messaging, right? So hijacking your text app and sending text to a premium number and jacking up your bill, that sort of thing. There's a lot of data stealing stuff, and there's also quite a lot of like gray area applications that are you know, basically exfiltrating your contact list, right? But not clearly doing something overtly bad, like you know, like jacking up your phone bill.
Right. So how do we use this information? How does this relate back to an enterprise? And, you know, how can they use this knowledge?
Well, so the other point was that on Android, one of the main, I guess, other than the platform currency problem, one of the main issues is not that Google's store does such a terrible job of vetting applications. It's that there's, you know, hundreds and hundreds of different app stores that you can use without jailbreaking your device, which is in stark contrast to Apple.
So this gets back to the philosophy, though, right? We want the openness. Now, in interest of full disclosure, I carry both an iPhone and an Android phone. I have one for personal, one for work. So I use them both. And, you know, there's a part of me that likes the openness and freedom of the Android as opposed to the closed ecosystem of Apple that's keeping me safe, right? Quote unquote. There's big quotes around that. But this is the downside, right? We have that freedom to install whatever we want, and look what happens. Bad things can more easily get onto the box.
Right.
You know, I'm okay with that trade-off in my personal life, but from an enterprise, this is where mobile device management and bring your own device starts to get really interesting. Because what are you going to do, right? You're going to mandate? Then it's not bring your own device anymore.
Yes.
And it gets interesting. So but I guess... Oh, go ahead.
Go ahead. I was going to say, back to your question of what can we do or what can we learn from this? You know, I think what we can learn is, number one, you've got to keep your devices up to date, because you know that if you've got a population of way out of date devices hanging off your network, you know, it's a risk. And the same thing if you let people install crap from, you know, risky places, that's also a risk. And the problem is I think this is where you were going, is that this is somebody's device, right? This is their personal device, not a company device. And who the heck are you, the company, to tell me what, you know, that I can't install the hacked version of Angry Bird Space
with Jedis.
With Jedis, that's right.
Yes. you know, and this gets into some of the MDM, like some of the MDM tools are kind of interesting because what they're trying to do is say, fine, whatever, you can do whatever you want on the personal container, but on the work container, we're going to isolate all this as best we can. And it'd be interesting to see how well those work against some of the common malware. You know, if we can containerize all the corporate data, is it something that we can keep from leaking out to the malware purview? I don't know. It'd be interesting to test. I think this is certainly a developing area. I'm actually a little surprised at how quickly mobile malware is growing. For a while there was that big, you know, boogeyman that was used to sell a lot of stuff, but wasn't a big real deal in the field. And now it's starting to be. You know, but when you look at it's growing 613%, well, when you're talking about small numbers, it's easy to go from, you know, a right. few to a lot, you know, to a more than a few and grow 613%. But we'll see. You know, I'm seeing more and more interesting stuff that is being pushed out to mobile, especially for things like mobile Salesforce and people on the road and things like, hey, you know, we want to push this out so you don't have to log into the VPN to get it. And you know, we're gonna have some problems here. You know, this is like similar to the days before we had the full disk encryption push on laptops. It's right. we've seen this cycle before, and we need to be careful. And I would really, really take a long, hard look at what data you're willing to put on a mobile device, regardless if it's corporate owned asset or employee owned asset.
I think that's really good advice. And by the way, I think that's good advice whether you're talking about a tablet, a phone, or a laptop.
Or my Palm Pilot.
Yeah, or your Palm Pilot.
You know, cutting edge. You know, there's no attacks against my Palm Pilot, mister.
Well, that's true. There's no attacks against my Windows NT server either.
That's why I run IBM OS 2 on my laptop.
Well, now, I think... Just to stick with this for one more minute, I think given the organization that I sit in, I see a lot of innovation and forward thinking, and I can tell you that at least from what I see, the maturation or the cycle of mobile devices is going to be far more compressed than PCs were. And I sure. really think we're going to see the adoption of, you know, of these mobile devices, whether it's a phone or a tablet, as you were just mentioning, way more quickly than we saw PCs become entrenched in the business. And so I would expect to see quite conceivably within the next 5 years, quite a lot of people using iPads and Android tablets as their primary work device rather than a laptop.
Yeah, I'm already seeing it. Some of the folks I work with primarily use a iPad, and you know, we're getting we've already got quad core devices on phones.
I know
the power's there. You know, then it becomes a matter of is it the right interface to actually do the job? But exactly. that's a whole different conversation. You know, but at the end of the day, yeah, you're right. It's going to become the primary platform, whether we like it or not, for most folks. And we're going to have to figure out how to control the data on those devices. And I don't really think we have a good answer right now. I like the MDM vendors, you know, in theory, but I think they're in their infancy. And I think that the very beginning of what that code probably needs to do to really, you know, be effective.
Yeah, I agree with that. All right, let's move on. The next story is, I think, probably relatively brief, but it's an important cautionary tale, I thought, that made sense to bring up. And that is about malicious browser extensions. You know, that there's an article in here from Network World.
Jerry, what is a browser extension?
Oh, you know, I think each of the browsers call it slightly something different, but, you know, plugins, basically, you know, the toolbars and different gadgets that you can install into your browser. And the issue here is that not all of them are good, right? And not all of the browser manufacturers or browser vendors and even security vendors really take them seriously as a serious threat, because, you know, they'll say, well, you know, that these browser objects can only run in the context of the browser. And, you know, which is true and probably good, like in the context of Chrome, which has a sandbox, but, you know, Firefox doesn't have a sandbox. I'm not really sure about Internet Explorer. I don't think it does. But, you know, the issue is that there aren't a lot of people paying attention to this. And, you know, I don't know if, you know, if you've ever taken a look at your mom's computer lately, but, you know, I've seen my mom's computer, and, you know, it's got freaking 32 different toolbars, and it's pretty, in a pretty effective way to get a foothold onto a computer. And most antivirus doesn't really play in that space.
I, for one, appreciate that the ask.com toolbar comes with a Java update. That's what I appreciate.
Yes.
They should so be slapped for that. Yeah, it's an interesting thing, right? It's just one more area of things to consider of, you know, this is another piece of code that could do some interesting things. And yes, even if I'm limited to the context of the browser, hey, you know, the browser is becoming really, really, really important.
And, that's right.
You know, if you look at certain folks, they say the browser is the OS, right? You do right. Almost everything in the browser now. So, you know, malicious extension is a wonderful way to get a foothold and grab data and do stuff. And I think you're right. The point of this story is that a lot of the vendors out there aren't looking at this yet as a vector for attack. So, you know, one more area where we need to be concerned. And I think, you know, you can look at this as typical ways of defending against it. Everything from having virtual browsers, which I think is an interesting way to do things that you blow away and recreate at the end of the day, or on demand. You know, some tools do that. Some people were suggesting having multiple browser instances, one for work stuff, one for personal stuff, you know, switching between IE and Firefox. There's some neat stuff where you can actually launch a completely self-contained version of Firefox off a USB key, you know, and use it only for certain instances in certain paranoid situations. Virtual desktoping, I think, can help this. Whitelisting could probably help this, I imagine. I would like to test some of that, but it's one more area that we should watch and be aware of.
Yeah, and I think that's really what I liked about this story is, you know, it's another thing that we really need to be cognizant of. We, you know, we like to take away admin rights, and we like to employ things like application whitelisting, but, you know, sometimes we're not really paying attention to this as a subtle backdoor. And, you know, some of those things may mitigate this, but, you know, I've seen some environments give, in particular, a lot of latitude to how people configure their browser, right? And so they don't necessarily think about locking down the actual browser itself and preventing people from installing things in it.
Yeah, it's clever, right? But this is the arms race. The bad guys are finding areas that are not being watched, and they go after it, which exactly. Makes sense. It's interesting. You know, one more thing to keep us up at night.
Absolutely. Speaking of that, the next article, also from Network World, there has been another spate of DNS hijacks, and this time there's been some pretty significant names involved. And this article talks about AVG and Avira, and you know, let's all say you know, say have a moment of silence for RedTube, right? And Alexa as well, but also not in the article. I think it was probably after the article was published. Metasploit and Rapid7 had their sites compromised too, and you know, this is fairly low tech.
Let's be clear that their sites weren't compromised. Their DNS fair enough. Records. Their DNS records were compromised.
Their sites were redirected.
Yes,
and they were redirected using a low tech attack.
Yeah,
with a fax machine.
Well. What do you trust, right? This is a nice little sort of weakness, right? We're very reliant on DNS, and I don't know that DNS gets enough sort of scrutiny, right? You know, if you're hosting your own DNS, it's pretty easy, right, to keep an eye on it, and you know what's going on. You know, as long as the root zones don't get compromised, you're okay. But if you're outsourcing your DNS in any way, you're basically relying on a whole lot of infrastructure for those A records to be correct, and for your username and passwords not get reset. And, you know, this is an area that I think is ripe for more security being built around it, whether it's two-factor authentication, whether it's, you know, other ways. You know, you've got to keep it somewhat user-friendly, right? Because this is a customer service sort of interaction. But at the same time, I think people take DNS for granted and they don't care enough about securing their DNS records.
Absolutely. So Johannes Ulrich actually put out a script that you can, it's just a quick and dirty script where it will periodically query the root DNS servers to figure out if your DNS has changed. You know, it can send you an alert. That was, I think, one of the few things you can do. I mean, because you're completely reliant on, you know, the security controls and the good.
Or bring your DNS in-house. I mean, that's possible. It depends, right? But your registrar is still pointing it at you.
That's the
so
problem.
So if they can go to the registrar and alter it there.
That's the problem.
Yeah, it's a challenge.
Yeah, so what you want to do is, and I think about the only thing you can do, other than making sure you pick a registrar that you feel, you know, adequately represents the, you know, the security values you have, and that's by the way a pretty difficult thing because it's a commodity service, is really paying attention and monitoring for chains and reacting to it as fast as you can, because you know, if in this case. Right, if you got some Palestinian group sending a very convincing fax to Network Solutions saying, "Hey, you know, we got locked out of our account. We need some help getting back in." You know, it doesn't matter if it's your DNS is in house. They're gonna repoint or change the root servers to something they control, and your DNS servers never get touched.
Yeah, and bad on NetSol for just trusting that fax, right? They should have a methodology where, you know, they have to call a known number to a known, you know, there are ways they could have architected that differently. But yeah, I mean, the fact of the matter is it worked.
Yeah, and by the way, I totally missed that Network Solutions got sold to web.com.
It was quiet. Yeah, it was not a big, like, trumpeted thing. I mean, it's funny because NetSol used to be, you know, serious. They were the bomb back in the day.
Oh yeah. Anyway.
So business idea: secure DNS registrar. You know what? To change it, you've got to send us your child.
DNA and in person.
Oh yeah, you know. But you're right. It's a commodity thing with, you know, race to the bottom. If Danica Patrick can't secure my DNS, who can?
Ooh, that's a, you know, hopefully somebody's listening.
I'm a born marketer. Hey, what's the number one threat these days?
Apparently it's insiders.
And are you skeptical?
I am skeptical.
I don't know. I read the article. So let's go ahead and intro the article, and then I'll just spoil the fun. I think if they include insiders being accidentally doing things, like following phishing links or installing software they shouldn't and being socially engineered and practicing unsafe browsing habits and inadvertently being a threat, I could somewhat agree with this statement.
Yeah, I think a lot does come down to semantics. How do you define insider? And I think that's one thing that is a little bit missing from the story. And I will admit, I haven't had time to actually read the report that is behind this story.
Wow.
I know.
You call yourself a podcast host.
Well, you know, I have a job. I got to pay for the bandwidth somehow.
Anyway, we should intro the story so people know what we're talking about.
Very, very good. So this story is, you know, also from Network World. Apparently we are whoring out Network World this week. The title of the story is Report Indicates Insider Threats Leading Cause of Data Breaches in the Last 12 Months. And that's pretty self-explanatory, but Forrester apparently commissioned a study, and the findings of that study were, I believe, that 36%, if I if I'm not mistaken, of incidents were attributed to insiders rather than outsiders. And, you know, so that, and that was the largest category of people, right? And when you break that down further, they assert that a lot of that's due to not being aware of good practices and company policy around data security and that sort of thing. And as you mentioned, I'm a little skeptical, and I'm skeptical for a couple of different reasons. Number one, from my own my own view on what's going on in the world, but also it doesn't really line up very well with a lot of the other studies that are going on. Except, as you pointed out, if we more broadly define a data breach, databreachdb.org is a fantastic site. If you've never used it, it's awesome and it's scary. You know, go on there and pick your vertical, pick a PHI or whatever you want, and the number one loss vector is usually stolen laptops or stolen or lost USB drives and things like that. And so my question is that an insider threat? So
you could say yes. But then I would say, in that particular instance, a stolen or lost USB drive or hard drive, how do we know that data was actually ever accessed, ever utilized, ever distributed, ever, right? It's a potential for a disclosure. It's a potential for, a breach, but was it truly a breach? Or was it some guy shipping to Nigeria and reformatted and sold it?
Well, I can tell you, it's depending on the regulatory domain you're in, but if you're in the health area, if you've got unencrypted PHI on your USB drive and it gets stolen, it doesn't matter. Gets accessed.
You have to disclose. Get that.
It's breached, basically.
Yeah, but that's by definition of compliance. It's not necessarily reality.
Right.
Right. So all that being said, the way I sort of read into this report is, if we include people, and the other thing they're including here is that if we include people internally for misuse and unintentional misuse, they go back to saying, well, the folks weren't aware of policy and they weren't aware of what they can and shouldn't do, and they didn't know they shouldn't put the credit card database on Dropbox so they can work out at home at night, and that kind of stuff. And there's something to be said for that. User awareness does matter. But at the same time, I always say that people still will make mistakes, and if you're relying totally on user training, you will fail. So, user awareness plus technology constraints is usually a better approach. In my personal opinion, but I don't know. I can see this, because especially a lot of approaches today from the bad guys are to get people to click on things internally first, right? Phishing emails or spear phishing campaigns or watering hole attacks. Ooh, spoiler alert.
And if all of those are included in the scope of insider threats, then I agree. I totally agree that.
Because really, The bumbling, junior analyst down the hall who doesn't know anything about information security and goes click happy is a threat, right?
Yeah.
They're a problem. And we're not allowed to break their fingers, so we got to do something.
Yeah, fair enough. I wish we could break their fingers.
You know what? That was Jerry Bell, not Andrew Callett, who said that. It was Jerry.
Oh, boy. So, again, how can we learn from this? The point of the article, there's some good ideas in the article, and it introduces the concept of this data protection framework. And number one is to identify your data. And I'll tell you, through personal experience, many organizations have an extraordinarily hard time with that very basic fundamental step of,
yep,
knowing what data they have and where it's at.
Yep. And it's so crucial, and so many organizations fail. It's so difficult, much less once they get it done, keeping up with it.
Yeah.
As new data is created.
Yeah, I mean, there's a reason why the contemporary advice is to encrypt every person's hard drive, because you have no idea what they've got, and you know, today versus tomorrow. So the next it all leads up to protecting the data, but you know, the point is, and I think this goes back very nicely to what we've been saying for quite some time, and that is, you really have to build this capability of detecting anomalous things happening, because you have to plan for people to get at your data. And you know, whether it's an insider or an outsider or somebody coming in through a watering hole attack or a phishing attack, or you know, compromising your server, or it's the some pissed off administrator leaving to go to a competitor tomorrow with all your data, if you're monitoring your data, you're doing it in a sensible way, you're going to see something.
Right. In theory.
In theory.
You're right. And it just comes back to the way I read this is, users are dumb. And, you know, that's a harsh way of saying it, but you cannot trust them. You have to plan for them to screw up. You have to plan for them to fail. And then how do you limit their damage?
Yes. Yes. And it pains me that the whole users are dumb thing pains me. But I think that's ultimately what you have to plan for.
Well, and when I say that, right, you know, it's overly harsh. It's overly cynical. The reality is the bad guys know the right level of, I guess, IT security knowledge the average user has, which is minimal, and it's understandably minimal. And they know how to exploit average personality traits to get people to do what they want. And there's only those freaks of nature like us who live and breathe the InfoSec world who can spot it easily. Most people can't. And so to say users are dumb is not fair. What it's to say is users don't live and breathe InfoSec every day, and nor should they, and they don't have the level of attention to detail to this stuff, or even knowledge that they should, because they have other things that they need to do and care about. But the end of the day, it still comes back to the fact that users are not equipped with enough of the right mindset and knowledge, nor do I think they ever will be, to combat this on their own.
Well, and I think
you can't rely on them.
I think the other thing is that their incentives are different, right? So the incentive for the average quote user is around productivity and,
right,
you know, and doing their job. It might be making a sale. It might be, you know, developing a marketing presentation. It might be whatever. It's not primarily how do I make sure that I don't lose my, you know, my customer list.
Right. You're right. Absolutely.
And so it's just different incentives. And you know, I'll go back to plug Andy Ellis's talk, because he talks quite a bit about this, that, you know, a lot of times when you think users are doing dumb things, it's often because you don't understand the context of how they, you know, how their job works. So anyhow, we beat that one to death. So, attack of the week.
We still need bumper music.
Yeah, we'll come up with something. Maybe maybe we'll come up with something over Halloween. It'll be scary.
It's true. It's true.
All right. So this week, I reached into the hat and I pulled out watering hole attacks.
Ooh. So when you say that, I think of being in Africa with a big gun, and I'm looking for everybody to gather on the watering hole so I can shoot my trophy and bring it home and mount it on the wall and piss off all the PETA people.
Well, that's pretty much what this is. So
let's do a brief intro.
I'll intro it by recapping a story, and this was a story that you had sent me. Earlier in the year, there was an attack against the Department of Labor's website. It was the, I don't remember, SEM was the acronym. site environmental matrices, I think. And basically it was a site that the Department of Labor uses to measure or track and measure toxic substances at different sites that, that are managed by the Department of Labor.
And so far, this story is not very exciting.
It's not very exciting. But some attackers compromised this site, and they included a an iframe that redirected to an exploit kit. And the intention was to compromise the computers of anybody that went to that site. And what was kind of novel about this was the types of people that would go to this site are somewhat narrow, right? You know, the average Joe doesn't go to this site. There's, you know, it was at the time theorized that whoever was perpetrating this attack was really going after people in the I guess what I'll call non-nuclear weapons, nuclear industry. So, you know, nuclear plants and that sort of thing. But now there's this new discovery about a similar kind of attack that apparently closely mirrors what was done against the Department of Labor website with 10 different oil and energy websites. And so these sites were compromised, you know, again, through the normal means. And I think most of these are believed to have been compromised through a common web developer whose credentials had been compromised. Anyway, the sites were modified again to include an iframe link to a exploit kit that offers up the normal poison ivy remote access Trojan. So a watering hole attack, if you're not already caught on, is when an attacker thinks about the population that he wants to target. Let's say energy people or nuclear scientists or, you know, financial people, and will say, I wonder what kind of site these people all would go to. And then you compromise one of those sites, and you basically, you know, let them come to you and download your malware. And now you've got a presence on their system, and you can have your way with them.
Well, that sounds awfully nefarious.
Indeed it is. And by the way, this is becoming the predominant attack method, you know, as opposed to phishing, right? So phishing has been historically the big avenue this sort of thing's happened by. But, you know, recent statistics have shown that this is indeed overtaking phishing because, you know, it doesn't require getting through a spam filter. It's, you know, it's leveraging, quote, trusted websites that these people, you know, potentially go to every day.
Yeah, it, that is the key, right? It's a trusted website. And so all that sort of stuff of don't go to weird websites, right? And don't go to things you don't know. All that goes out the window, right? Because ultimately this is a trusted website that they need to go to do their job. It's a nasty little attack.
Absolutely. So now we're going to talk about how we defend against it.
I unplug everything and I cry in the corner in a fetal position.
Well, you know, that would be effective.
It would be. No, seriously. I came up with a few. First of all, by the way, just to show that we do some research here, I want to credit RSA for coming up with the term watering hole attack. That's who originally coined this back in the day in 2012. So thank you, RSA.
Impressive. See the value we add.
It's true. Feel free to send any and all contributions to our not yet set up PayPal contribution account. Get on that, Jerry. So I had some ideas on how you defend against it. It's, you know, at the end of the day, it's one, realistically, it's one more vector of attack, right? But it's a nasty vector of attack. So it kind of goes back to what we were talking about earlier about browser extensions. There's a bunch of things you could do depending on your level of sophistication and your environment and culture. One of them that I like a lot is the NoScript add-on, which shuts down a whole bunch of things from your browser being able to do. However, this is not a scalable and not a user-friendly option. NoScript works great for computer-savvy folks and admins and folks who know what the hell they're doing. It is not a good option for Susie the secretary and Bob the admin.
It will make your administrative assistant cry.
Yes, yes. But it does really, really, really shut down a lot of avenues attack against the browser. Sandboxing your browsers, virtual browser instances, and the problem with that is what you're basically doing is you're letting your browser get compromised. But you're destroying that instance so that that compromise is short-lived. However, during that time, that compromise might be doing something bad. Right. Same thing with a virtual desktop environment, which is another potential avenue for defense. You have a virtual desktop environment, and then you blow it away and rebuild it on a regular basis. But while it's up and running, that compromise could be active. Now, the good news is you shorten the length of time that that compromise could exist, which is good.
But after you get compromised, potentially, if you then subsequently go log into something else, your credentials could get compromised.
Yeah, absolutely. And that is the downside to some of these sort of virtual desktop instances or virtual browser instances or sandboxing is that, you need to be aware of how long it's persistent for. Whitelisting, I think, is a good approach in this circumstance. I do think whitelisting, again, it's got administrative overhead, but it's not nearly as bad as it used to be, is an effective technique to stop a lot of this if run properly. What about you? Have you come up with any other ideas, Mr. Bell?
Yeah, so I've got a few. First one is, I think, a slightly different take, and that is putting your internet browsing into a VDI, right? So you don't do any intranet. So basically, the concept would be your PC can only access your intranet. If you want to get to the internet, you have to connect to a VDI instance. And that VDI instance can't connect back into the organization. So you couldn't, for instance, log into Facebook and then log into your webmail or something like that from the same browser session. It just wouldn't work because of firewall rules. So that's one. Another one that I have been doing personally is deploying web filtering. And one of the effective techniques is to use web filtering. And by the way, I would recommend that you look at agent-based web filtering. So something that sits on the website, on your PC, in addition to network-based. And the reason is that, if I take my laptop out of the office and I don't VPN in, I'm not being filtered. So, I like having something that's enforcing a policy all the time. But back to the policy, the thing that I found to be very effective is to obviously block the categories that you find concerning, but almost every web filtering system allows you to block uncategorized domains. And so when you look underneath the covers of these attacks, the way it works is these websites are very, very subtly altered to include an iframe. And that iframe redirects to another domain. And that other domain, in almost every case, has just been set up.
Right. So it's not known by the web categorization software or the proxy or whatever it is. And so
exactly.
If it's not known, and it's somewhat equivalent of kind of like whitelisting, right? If it's not known,
right,
categorized, known, safe, don't allow traffic to go to it. So that would prevent your browser via the proxy or whatever it may be from connecting to that third-party site,
right,
which I think would be clever.
Right, so I found that is relatively effective. Whitelisting, as you mentioned, is also a good thing. I have seen some organizations whitelisting, as opposed to filtering undesirable websites, they have a fairly narrow list of acceptable websites.
That definitely has an administrative overhead. There's some cultural issues there. You know, that comes with some costs that you have to consider.
It depends on your organization. You know, it really, if you make widgets and, you know, you don't have a lot of business being on the internet, it might work. But if you have, you know, a support group where people need to be Googling how to fix a printer problem, you know, that's probably not going to work.
Yep. Yep. And, you know, we see today, you know, hiring managers and HR firms talk about if you're too restrictive in your internet use policy, you'll lose some of the best talent to the company down the street that allows them to do whatever they want. And, you know, that is a cost to be considered in things like this. But
So you know, that's actually something that I have considered. And I'll tell you that hits close to home personally. And if you believe it is a competitive advantage to enable people to, you know, roam the internet at will, you know, there are other options. You know, you can at the same time say, you know what, we have to take some draconian measures because the at least the perceived risk to our organization from unfettered access is too high for us. You know, give them an iPad and guest wireless internet or something like that. You know, it doesn't have to be big and fancy. It doesn't have to be, I guess point is there's some out of the box ideas that you can come up with if that's something that's really important to your business. You know, it's as you keep saying, it's all local, right? It's all dependent on what's appropriate for your organization.
Indeed, indeed. So I think it's a lot of good ideas. And, you know, at the end of the day, I think, a watering hole attack is just another vector. And, you know, the same block and tackling applies. But it's a very clever vector that we need to be aware of.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, you mentioned it before. This is one of those areas where awareness training just isn't going to play, right?
No. It's not going to. There's not much you can do at the user end. You know, it's got to probably be a technological solution on this one.
Yeah, yeah, and it's not. There's not a perfect solution. It is defending against an adversary that has the upper hand.
Yep.
So. Anyway, those were my ideas.
So. They're good. They're good.
All right. So I think that's it.
Indeed, indeed. It's been another fun show, and hopefully people have found some value in our ramblings and conversations. And, you know, as always, we love feedback. Feel free to send us notes. Jerry will give out all that information. You know, we get all giddy when we get an email.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I giggle like a schoolgirl. It's embarrassing.
That happens all the time, though. I mean, that's...
Absolutely. All right. Well, thank you very much for listening. This has been episode 38. And as usual, if you have any comments, questions, feedback, you know, things you'd like us to do, talk about, whatever, send us an email to info@defensivesecurity.org. You can find the show notes for all the stories we talked about tonight on the website at www.defensivesecurity.org. You can find Mr. Callett on Twitter at Lerg, L-E-R-G. You can find me at Malicious Link. You can follow the show at DefensiveSec. And with that, I bid you adieu for another week. Take care. Bye.